innovation globally has primarily been led by startups. And I actually think that there is a shift coming. I think the next 50 years of innovation is going to be led by corporates, or perhaps corporate startups or corporate ventures.
Welcome to the Lost in Transformation podcast series dedicated to the complex world of digital transformation. We feature guests from large corporations, startups, consultancies, and more to shed light on the success factors around innovation, transformation, and adjacent topics. We share firsthand insights and inspiration from experts for all the entrepreneurs, entrepreneurs, and anyone curious about digital transformation. Sam Hall is the CEO of Asia Pacific at Rainmaking, a corporate innovation and venture development firm. After a big career switch, he's now on a mission to provide an environment for growth and create impact with his work. Learn more about his views on corporate innovation and why the window of opportunity for startups is closing. We hope you enjoy this episode. So, hi, Sam. It's a pleasure to have you here on our podcast. And in this episode, we want to dive a bit deeper into your role at Rainmaking, a corporate innovation and venture building company, and also into your personal mission to empower people, which we're going to get into a little bit later. So to start off, could you tell us a bit more about how you got into venture building in the first place?
Of course. So thank you for hosting me. I'm very happy to be here with you guys. So yes, so my role is, so I run Rainmaking here in APAC. And Rainmaking, like you said, is a new venture build company. So we power new venture creation. And we typically do that in tandem with corporate partners. When I first started my career, I worked with corporate partners, or I should say corporate clients, but certainly not on venture building. So I actually started out as a corporate lawyer. Back at the start of my career, I studied law. I did some criminal prosecution with the UN, and I ended up working in London for a big corporate law firm. And I think the reality is that in that part of my career, I felt quite stifled by the ways of working and by the substance of the work that I was doing. I felt quite stifled by the sort of status quo approach and the hierarchical structure that I saw in that environment. And I felt that the work I was doing was primarily administrative. I felt a lot of the time, my role was to operationalize strategic decisions that had already been made. So execution, I think, rather than creation. And that was not particularly interesting to me. For me, what I'm excited about is not necessarily being the cog in the machine, but creating the machine that delivers the impact. And so feeling stifled was something that I needed to get away from. And my path to venture building was really at the time when I stopped being a lawyer, I didn't particularly know what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to do something different. And I knew I needed to explore, and I had some ideas, but I took a sort of lean startup approach to figuring out what my career transition should be. And at the time, I did not know that, because at the time, to be honest, I didn't know much about lean startup, and I certainly didn't know where I was going. It was a bit more haphazard. But in retrospect, the way I look back to it, I had a bunch of assumptions about what I thought I wanted to do and where I wanted to get to. And I really just ran experiments by working with different companies, in different companies, you know, founding different companies, looking at different value propositions and just learning by doing it. And so over time, I sort of fastened into the type of work that I was quite excited about doing. And that type of work was working at the early stage of new venture creation to identify where there might be value in the future and what proposition might potentially position to capture that value. And that got me very excited and still gets me very excited and very passionate because I no longer feel stifled. I feel like I'm in a position to create and in a position to identify interesting, exciting areas of opportunity and what might be possible rather than these are the bounds that we're working within and how do we maneuver and navigate within those particular constraints. So I like to sort of step back and say, what can we potentially achieve in a space and how can a space potentially look different? And I think that when I was younger, when I was studying and when I was in my legal career, I didn't necessarily think about a career as a venture builder. And I think in reality, this is a sort of space and industry which is fast growing now and has been for the past sort of decade or so. But back then, it wasn't necessarily an avenue that many people would think about. This is exactly where I'm going to go. And I think that there's many companies now, Rainmaking included, that are really building the future of that space. And that's really exciting because it's almost a sort of new venture creation within an industry. That's pretty interesting for me.
And because you said you have felt stifled in your own position. And do you have some kind of tips to people who feel the same way in where they are now on how to get unstuck?
I think it's incredibly important, I guess, number one, to be very, very honest with yourself about what excites and inspires you. And that is very different for different people. And it's not that anything is right or wrong, but you need to look inside yourself and understand what drives you, what type of work you like doing. And that need not be the same type of work that your peer group enjoys or likes doing. And I think many people, at least if I speak from my own experience, you know, I ended up being a lawyer because I kind of jumped through a bunch of hoops out of school into university, into law school, into a law firm, without particularly analyzing or understanding what else there might be out there. It seemed like a sensible route. It seemed like a route with transferable skills. And probably that's a failing on my part. And once you're in a specialism, and law is very much a specialism, once you're in a specialism, it becomes increasingly difficult to get out of it, because everything that you've learned readies you for work in that space. So I think you have to be, number one, very honest about what you want versus what you've done. So what you aspire to versus what your CV says. And the two, if you're transitioning, are very different than usually. And the second one then is not to be preoccupied with what your peer group thinks about you, or not to hold too much weight on what your friends think and what your colleagues think and you know, what your family thinks and things like that. Listen to all of these people, like understand their perspective, but it's only you who can understand the way that you feel. And the reality is that in the work that I was doing, I felt very unfulfilled. And that then became a bit of a nagging preoccupation for me. And that was a sort of undercurrent that I took with me outside of work. And that's very debilitating to constantly be unexcited about what you're doing day to day. Like, work is such a massive piece of who we are as people and what we do in our lifetime. So I think it's incredibly important you are inspired and excited by it.
Yeah, yeah. And how has your own career journey of escaping that unfulfilled career to now becoming happy with what you're doing, how has that impacted your work and mission now?
Well, it's made me acutely aware of the importance of that, both for myself, obviously, but also for the people that I work with. And in the same way that I want to work on exciting, inspiring topics, I want to work with people who are excited and inspired about the work that they're doing. I want to work with very aspirational, ambitious people. And I want to work with people who care about constantly being feeling alive with the work that they're doing. So not people who are willing to phone it in, not people who are willing to sort of accept that work is a treadmill and just keep walking along that treadmill, but people who want to create, people who want to build companies together in a micro level, but also for us in Rainmaking, so people who want to build our company as an aspirational, ambitious, forward-thinking, growing company. And I think that it becomes very important then for me in my position running the business here in this region to create that environment for our people to be able to do that. So one thing I'm very passionate about is fulfillment in the workplace and career fulfillment. And I think that one of my biggest obligations to the people in my company is to offer that to them and offer them an environment that allows them to develop and grow, to work with inspiring, aspirational people, but also to work on inspiring, impactful projects and portfolios. And that's something that I'm acutely aware of. And if I'm very honest about it, then the type of work that we do, new venture creation, we're seeking to identify opportunities that have not yet been achieved and ultimately to make breakthroughs. And if we are to make breakthroughs, then we have to have a very strong, effective process, methodology, and understanding about what we're doing and how we're doing it. We also need to have elite talent. And for us to genuinely attract and engage and retain elite talent in this space, then we have to be very, very sympathetic to what elite talent wants. And it wants to be inspired. It wants to be excited. It wants to be fulfilled. And it wants to deliver impact. So from a personal human perspective, I want to support my people because that makes me proud and I'm passionate about it. And from a sort of commercially selfish perspective, if we don't do that, then we won't achieve what I want us to achieve as a company and what we as a partnership want us to achieve as a company. So it's incredibly important. And as you can see, it's something I'm super passionate about.
So you're creating this impact now also in the corporate venture building world. Yeah. And yes, so you've also seen quite a number of new ventures come to life and you've worked with quite a lot of startups. Are there any noteworthy ones that you can share about, like as in their mission or why you like working with them?
You're right that I have worked with a lot of startups. So Rainmaking, we own and operate a company called Startup Bootcamp, which is an early stage startup accelerator. We don't do that anymore in this region. We focus very much on sort of later stage corporate innovation activities. So basically new venture creation and co-venturing with growth stage startups outside of accelerator programs and things like that. So what I'll actually talk about is more that corporate venture side. And there's one that I find particularly interesting, partly because it's something that is reasonably new. We sort of brought that to market last year, and partly because of the potential impact and just the sort of human impact it can have. So we've instituted a target or a requirement internally that 75% of all of the projects that we do working with corporates to build new ventures are supporting in some way at least one of the UN SDGs. And impact is a big piece of our company and our sort of culture. And one of the companies that I think is particularly exciting is a company focused on access to irrigation. So this is a company that we ideated, identified, and then validated with a large energy provider that sits across renewable energy and multiple different aspects in that space. And the opportunity started with access to energy. So we know that there are many people globally in emerging economies who do not have consistent, effective access to energy. And this impacts basically the outcomes that they can achieve in their lives, because it impacts their ability to build business, but it also impacts their ability to grow wealth, and it impacts their ability to provide education for their families and things like that. And we started in this space, access to energy. And through the validation process, we narrowed down on an opportunity, access to irrigation for smallholder farmers in emerging communities. And ultimately, what we've then identified and validated and taken to market and is now growing is a startup business, which provides solar-powered irrigation equipment to these smallholder land farmers and allows them to achieve better yields and allows them to therefore achieve better revenues and more consistent revenues, but also doing so with clean energy rather than the diesel pumps that previously they were using. And this is something that we're building now in APAC, and it's super exciting for us, partly because we think it's a cool, interesting, high-value business, but also because it's delivering impacts, not just from an environmental standpoint, but it's also delivering impact to these individuals and allowing people, entrepreneurs, farmers, to basically build better lives and better outcomes for their families.
Right, right. I really like that you're also focusing on the UN SDGs. I think that's a nice way to create impact in different areas as well. And I see you also have quite a lot of experience with innovation in also in the startup and in the corporate world. And how do you see this world changing now when you compare it now with how it was over the last 5-10 years or so?
Well, I think it's always changing, as we should expect. I personally believe that the sort of past 20 years, shall we say, innovation globally has primarily been led by startups. And I actually think that there is a shift coming. I think the next 50 years of innovation is going to be led by corporates, or perhaps corporate startups or corporate ventures. And the reason is that, you know, if we look at the most powerful, influential companies in the world today, the vast majority of those are, of course, not startups. But they're also not recent startups. The vast majority of those are sort of status quo established market leaders and have been for many, many years. There are a small number of breakthrough companies that have effectively broken through in the last 20, 30 years. And then the sort of most recent, earliest examples are the ones like Amazon and Google. And then beyond that, all the household names in terms of the Facebooks and the Airbnbs and the Ubers and all these companies. And year on year, of course, there are a few more startups that become scale-ups, that become very well established, that become global behemoths. And year on year, as these companies break through, one or two of those established status quo larger companies inevitably falls out of the biggest group of companies, however, whatever number you want to put on that, 300, 400, 500, 1,000, whatever it is. And I think that there are many reasons why startups have been able to break through in this way over the last 20, 30 years. But I think the biggest one is that startups have got entrepreneurial competence, they've got competent institutional competence of new business building, of new venture creation. And I think corporates that are running established status quo existing businesses are very, very good at running those businesses. And they are very, very good at creating efficiencies and improving the business and evolving and incrementally taking the business forward. But they don't have the same institutional competence of new business building. And I think it's very difficult to have that institutional competence in new business building at scale. What they do have are fantastic assets, huge, huge amounts of different assets in different spaces. So whether that's customer base, whether that's infrastructure, whether that's distribution channels, whether that's access to C-suite and boardrooms of customer development, whatever it might be, they have an enormous number of assets, but they don't have that competence in the main of institutional new business building, whereas startups do. And so what we've seen with these companies breaking through in the last 20, 30 years is that competence can outperform assets alone. But my belief, and I guess the belief of everything we do around new business building and rainmaking, is that competence plus assets will always trump competence alone. And so to the extent that corporates can develop this institutional competence of new venture building, then actually the window of opportunity for startups closes. And I believe that the window of opportunity for startups is closing. And this is, you know, really why I'm in the space where I am and why we're doing what we're doing, because we believe the greatest impact can be achieved by leveraging that institutional competence in new business building, leveraging that entrepreneurial competence, and leveraging that in tandem with the established corporate assets. And that allows you to achieve validation and get to market faster and potentially achieve greater impact with the businesses that you're building. So I firmly believe that the future of innovation will be corporate startups or corporate partnered startups. And that's really why I do the work that I do.
So you're thinking that the future, or what's going to be more powerful in the future, is like co-owning or like co-building these startups than with the whatever the corporates can give, like assets and so on?
So I guess what it comes down to is that when you build a new startup, you identify a space and you say, I think there's an opportunity in this space to deliver value. And at this point in time, I don't necessarily know how I will deliver that value, but I think there is an untapped need here. And I think that it's a significant need. And I think that there must be a way to solve it. And then you explore, first you validate if that need is generally true. If it is, then you explore how you might be able to solve that. And you, the way I think about company building and building startups is it's a long, long, long series of boxes that must be ticked, a long, long series of stepping stones that must be crossed. And you don't know, you may have a vision as to where you will eventually get to. You don't know exactly how you will get there, what the path will look like. And you don't really know exactly what the sort of solution will look like when you do get there. But you think there must be a way to achieve and deliver this value. And so for each of those stepping stones to cross or boxes to tick, it's something that must be true or something that you must be able to work around. So you will design an experiment, and in reality, many experiments, to find a way to tick that box and get one step closer to achieving the vision that, that you have set out. So if you and I built a startup in the wild, we might set out 100 boxes. Now, in reality, we'd set out many more. If you and I did it in the wild, then every time we want to tick one of those boxes, run one of those experiments, it will take us X period of time. If you and I do that leveraging corporate assets, then my belief is, and our experience is, that it doesn't take X period of time. It now takes half of X, or it takes, you know, a quarter of X, or it might take an eighth of X. And the reason for that is when you have corporate assets that you can leverage, you can get to validation far quicker. You can generate data far quicker. You can generate greater volumes of data far quicker. You can run experiments far quicker. And good example is we did a venture build where we needed to run some experiments in warehouse space. We did not, in the wild, if that was me and you building a business, then we'd have to go and partner up with a company who provide us with warehouse space. And that may take some time, and it may sort of push us back with our development process. In reality, we were doing this with a corporate partner that has an inordinate amount of warehouse space. So on day one of the process, we just started running those experiments. And it means that we can validate or invalidate some assumptions far more quickly. And if then there are 100 steps to take, you are compounding risk by doing that without assets. Because whilst it takes you 3 months versus a week, 3 months times 100 versus a week times 100, you start to see that you'll get to your solution far quicker if you're able to leverage assets to do this. And that's a very sort of simplified way of looking at why I think the value of corporate assets is so important when building new ventures.
So assuming that all of this is true, and corporate assets can help you to speed up the discovery process, and at the same time, taking into account that we have seen quite a few corporate startups also starve for actual access to these assets because they are gatekeepers to these assets. How do you best interface with the people in the corporation who are the de facto gatekeepers to your access to that?
My personal way of thinking about it, and I think the way that we approach this, is we as a company We want to build companies where we are effectively co-founders with our corporate partners. And when we're doing that, we're putting our own investment in, and we're putting our own time and effort and resource into building a company. So we make an investment decision as to whether we want to do something. If we're building a company with a corporate partner where we believe that there is a de facto gatekeeper, as you talk about, which I think is exactly the way to talk about it, who doesn't have the same agenda or doesn't have the same appetite to put the assets on the table, then that factors into our investment decision about whether we want to be a part of this. If I take myself out of the equation, I look at it from a corporate perspective. So a corporate who is venture building, then if I'm in charge of that new venture creation function within the corporate, then I would be gearing my portfolio towards assets where I can genuinely get access. And I will be running experiments in the early stages to identify if my assumption and if what I'm hearing from the gatekeepers about, yes, willingness to put assets on the table is actually true. Because I think that you're completely right, that if you are not able to leverage those assets, then you may as well be building it in the wild. And if you may as well be building it in the wild, then what's the point of doing it as a corporate venture? Because all of a sudden, the fundamental objective I'm seeking to achieve, which is to de-risk at every turn, you can't achieve it if you don't have access to the assets. Another way to think about it is there's not much value in a corporate building a new business in a space where it's not genuinely leveraging its assets. Because what it's then doing is competing with any startup in the wild that's doing the same thing. The benefit that I think is at play here is that if you can leverage your assets, if you can really leverage the assets, then you are able to outcompete startups in the wild. But like you say, if you're not able to genuinely leverage those assets, it's probably not a place where you should be playing.
So then basically, would we follow that a bit further, the ability to access and then leverage those assets comes back to mindset of the people who are in charge of potentially protecting them, and therefore also in a way to culture when it comes to the overall company. So if we think about somebody freshly recruited into a corporation, let's say the setup is fairly ideal in terms of their reporting line, in terms of the resources, what kind of cultural or mindset initiatives or shifts do you see necessary in order to create that ground where you can actually come in?
So I think that mindset is right, but I think that the mindset is underpinned by and builds on top of incentivization. So I think that typically a person's mindset, and typically what I've seen within corporates and where you start to see frictions with new venture building, is where the mindset that you might need is not supported by the incentivization of the individuals that need to support it. So where we find it interesting to build is when we're working with senior stakeholders who have expectation or an obligation to deliver new creation, to deliver, you know, top line growth, or they have an obligation to identify opportunities where they can invest significant capex and they can grow. And from our perspective, once you have an aligned incentivization in that respect, then all of a sudden the mindset comes to where you need it to be. Whereas if what you're trying to do is change mindsets by cultural initiatives, but you're not changing the underlying incentivization, what people will be judged on internally, how it will make them look internally, how it will help them to further their career and development, then it's very difficult because it becomes the sort of cultural transformation becomes a little bit of a charade, or it becomes something that would be amazing to have. But if it's not underpinned by fundamentally what they will be judged on, then it's very difficult for that to then play out day by day.
And then following that, I'm then also thinking about your model where typically when you set up a venture activity, it's always with people recruited in from the outside rather than actual employees of the corporation taking on the role as the entrepreneurs and the people running it. What do you think is the reason in your mind that people from the outside might be better suited for the kinds of activities that you are running and proposing?
So I should first clarify that it's not always in our model people coming from the outside. You're right that in the main, and particularly in this part of the world, we do a lot of new venture creation where we bring in founders effectively from outside the corporate. But we also know that to be able to leverage assets and to be able to understand the corporate and not to be a sort of siloed new venture outside. It often makes sense to have somebody on the team, some form of liaison who does come from within the corporate. We also do new venture creation, which is entirely sort of coached and guided for internal teams. And that's when we sort of help internal teams to build and identify their own new ventures and create. So we don't exclusively do external entrepreneurs coming and building things. However, you are right that in a lot of cases, that's what we do. And my belief is that that's probably the most effective way of doing this. And so the way we approach that and why we think that that's quite important is I believe that there are five things you need to solve for when you're doing corporate venture building. And that's talent, ideation, process, governance, and funding. And I believe that talent is one of the most difficult to solve for. And the reality is that there are many, many startups in the world, and there are many, many entrepreneurs, and there are a few that are very, very good. And what we've seen in the last 20, 30 years is that when you have good entrepreneurs and when you have institutional competence in your business building, you can achieve great success. But the process that I believe that one should apply when building companies, the process of new business building, and that competence that I've been talking about, is not something that I think is encouraged or developed within the sort of status quo structures of a corporate. And effectively, if you are seeking to build a new business and you pull somebody out from a team within your existing corporate, then you're not putting in place somebody who is a professional at doing that work. And what you're then doing is almost diminishing the discipline of entrepreneurialism or startup building. So if you needed somebody to come in and be your CFO, you would hire somebody who has the appropriate background and context and has been doing that for many years. If you wanted somebody to come and create your group strategy, same thing. If you want somebody to identify, validate, and build new businesses, what you should in theory do is hire somebody to do that or find somebody to do that who has a experience and competence and demonstrable portfolio of having done that, because then you're effectively saying, look, we have a need and we have somebody who can solve for that. So that's why we start by our sort of starting point is to say, let's get entrepreneurs from outside the corporate. Otherwise, you're coaching and developing. And if you're coaching and developing and training and allowing people to learn on the job, then you're stacking risk. So as you talk about before, every stepping stone that you need to cross, you don't want to waste time and you don't want to stack risk. So if you have somebody who has built and run multiple businesses previously, then they have that muscle memory from having done it. And they have an understanding of the process from having done it. And they have an experience identifying experiments from having done it. And so better that you have somebody who can apply all of that immediately rather than somebody who needs to be coached and trained and developed and learn whilst doing to be able to do that. So that's simply the reason why I think it's more effective to have entrepreneurs who come from outside, because they can immediately get to work as entrepreneurs. But I don't think it necessarily makes sense to have a team which is 100% drawn from outside of the corporate, because if you are to genuinely leverage assets, then it's quite important to have some form of liaison or somebody within the team who understands what the mechanics of within that corporate look like and is able to therefore get access to assets as needed or support with that internal navigation.
How do you think about the composition of founding teams? I've seen quite a few builders that are actually looking at like psychological tests, Myers-Briggs and stuff like this, or personal attitude and aptitude, trying to put together teams that kind of cover sort of 360 view on some of these topics. Is that something you also pay attention to or subscribe to?
Well, the ones you talk about specifically in terms of putting the founding team together, I think you have to break it down into two phases. I think there's almost a validation team and then a post-validation founding team. And the skill set of those people might be quite different. So for me, the validation team, you need people there who understand corporates and who understand startups, but you need people who can do sort of deep strategy analysis, people who can identify shifts that are occurring in this particular industry and therefore where value may be created in the future. For us, the way we approach this work, we look at startups as signals as to where value is moving to. And we look at the emergence of new business models and what is the unit of competition within those business models. So what then becomes very important are people who understand business model innovation and people who have the intellectual agility and I think the imagination to think about what could a raft of different potential business models in this space look like? How can I leverage or learn from analogs in different industries of business models that have succeeded or business models that have not succeeded and why they've not succeeded? How can I leverage those analogs to think about what might be possible in this space? And typically, in my view, people who are good at that are people who've just been involved in startup ecosystems, people who've been building new businesses, people who've been creating and seeing many examples cross their path. In terms of like how the team then comes together once you get to post-validation, then I think it's incredibly important that you have people who have complementary skill sets and work well together. But I think you need to rely on the founding, the very immediate founding team, so CEO, CTO, to do a lot of the recruitment rather than to have it done for them, because they're the people who are going to lead and inspire and guide this team moving forward. So I don't think it's for us to say, look, this is the emotional, psychological characteristics that this perfect team must be. We can support and guide and advise on that. But we believe that once there's a core founding team in place, they're the ones who will build out the remaining team.
How do you think about the right amount of validation that it takes before actually launching into a new business? Are there any frameworks that you're using for that? Are there any references that you typically use? What does that right trade-off look like for you between risk and reward and launching too early versus launching too late?
So I think the most important thing in terms of validation is not to be overly prescriptive about how long that should take. And I've seen approaches where you say, look, it's going to take us 3 months to get to problem validation. And it's then going to take us 3 more months or 6 months or 5 months or 12 months or whatever it might be to get to solution validation. And at that point, we're going to make an investment of X into this business. And whilst prescription is useful in terms of getting everybody aligned around this is how we're going to work on a portfolio of ventures over the next period of time, I think the reality is that different ventures, different ideas, different businesses need different amounts of validation. And some need far more customer development before you understand exactly what is this problem that you're solving. And some you first identify an area that you believe there is a problem to be solved, but as you explore it and as you generate more data and as you generate more customer insights, you realize that it's not that particular area where you will build your business, but it's something ancillary or linked. But then you have to go through an additional piece of customer development to understand exactly what that problem is that you're going to solve. So as soon as you be prescriptive, you start forcing a decision, a go, no-go as to whether you will move forward without necessarily having sufficient data. I think you have to be open to different validation periods taking different amounts of time. In terms of what you need to see, it entirely depends what your approach is as an investor. I can really only talk about from our perspective when we are interested to move forward with an idea. And for us, we want to see that there's a genuinely large opportunity in a space that we believe is interesting as part of our portfolio. And that's the sort of key. Is there a big opportunity here? Is there something to be built? Is there a customer demand here? Or do we believe there's an emerging customer demand here? And what we do, therefore, is in that initial stage of validation, we're trying to understand where is the customer demand moving to? Where will the value be in the future? And like I talked about before, to do that, we're looking at what are the emerging pockets of value based on signals that we can see. And those signals may be macroeconomic, top down, but crucially, we look at signals from the startup community. So we're looking at what are the emerging validated business models at Series A plus stage? Where do we see density of similar business models or in similar industries or similar use cases? And what does that mean in terms of how that industry will reconfigure? And therefore, we hypothesize about where the value will sit. And if we think, yes, that's a genuinely large opportunity that could potentially be a very valuable business, then we're kind of interested to explore if there is a way to solve for that potentially. But the other key bit for us is there a genuine opportunity to leverage an asset, a corporate asset that will support us to solve for that. So if there's just a fantastic opportunity, large space, super interesting, we believe the world is moving in this way, but we don't have a corporate partner that we can work with a asset to solve for that, then you're effectively building a startup in the wild, which is not a bad thing, but it's not our thesis around how we build.
I really like the non-prescriptiveness and of course the model where you can take your time to either iterate within an opportunity, or of course also to abandon it at any point in time. And I think all of that speaks to the model that you have, as opposed to many other venture builders that actually get compensated quite a bit for the work put in rather than on a pure success basis, which I find incredibly honest about the model that you run. But for me, that, for example, raises the question that I'm curious about. How do you measure your own success? How do you know that you, as Rainmaking, are on the right track?
Well, are we building a portfolio where we're delivering, impacting, and creating equity value? So from our perspective, it's important, like I mentioned before, that the majority of the projects that we're working on are supporting broader impact. So supporting UN SDGs and supporting environmental impact or social impact and things like this. That's incredibly important for us. But then we also want to be building businesses that are creating equity value for us. So as our portfolio grows, then we need to be building businesses that we're year on year, we don't expect everything to succeed. Our sort of historic portfolio of rainmaking companies, about a third of them have done very well, about a third of them have failed and been closed down, and about a third of them somewhere in the middle, and we will find out. And from our perspective, as long as we can keep moving forward, working with corporates, building new business, and achieving, you know, that sort of ratio of success, then that's exciting for us and we're excited to keep doing it.
What are some of the difficulties that you might have had in the past when talking to corporates about this model and explaining to them how it works, getting buy-in for that, setting that up? Which hurdles are you facing when you go out and speak to potential new partners?
I think the accepted paradigm is a relationship of consultancy. And you alluded to it just before, whereby there is an interest amongst corporates to build new ventures or work in this space. And the existing paradigm is, you guys have some competence that we don't have, and you can help us to do this, and we will pay you project fees to do that. So on a consultancy basis. And from our perspective, we're not particularly interested to work on that basis. We'd rather work as partners and co-founders. And there's really two reasons. One is the genesis of our company, which is a handful of entrepreneurs who created a studio where they all owned in the studio rather than in the individual ventures. So it incentivized everybody to work collaboratively and share in the upside, also share in the downside. And we like to take the same approach with our corporate partners, where we share in the upside of the ventures and the work that we do. So we share in the success of the projects rather than potentially delivering projects without impact, but still walking away with our consultancy fees. And we also think that the model then allows us to focus on the right behaviors. So we worry that in this space where everything is uncertain with building new ventures and many things will fail, we believe that consultancy models don't necessarily engender the right behaviors amongst the consultant, simply because you do phase one, and we talked about prescribed periods of validation and things like that. So you say, look, we're going to do 3 months of validation or 6 months of validation. It's going to cost you X. And at the end of that, we'll have a go, no go. You might be incentivized to say, okay, well, now we'll do phase two. So we didn't quite get the validation we needed, or the data suggested that we maybe shouldn't do this. So let's actually move in this different direction, because then we can get our money for phase two and we can get our money for phase three. Whereas the way we do it is we're focused on only moving forward if it makes sense for us to do so, because we're going to be investing at every stage of the process. And that can be in financial terms, and it can be in sweat equity. It can be in terms of the effort and the resource that we're going to put on the table to work on this. But we therefore only want to work on projects where we do believe that the data suggests that we're moving in the right direction, there's a valuable business to be built. And we also know that we have a finite number of roster spots in terms of our portfolio. We can only build X number of businesses, and we only have Y amount of senior partner time within the company to focus on these different businesses. So we therefore only choose to add things to our roster if we do believe that there is a, you know, a high potential for this to be a generally impactful business. And that's really why we're set up in the way we are with that model. Now, to the difficulty that we face in terms of being in the market, I think that that model is, you know, increasingly well understood, but it's not the status quo model. And so people do still, you know, sort of talk to me as a consultant and think about me and us as consultants. And I think that's a positioning that we're trying to avoid. But that's probably one of the key things to change, I think, to see this type of venture building really grow.
Maybe also looking a bit towards the future with all the changes that are going on, you being exposed to so many different industries and getting a lot of signals all over the place, what is happening, what that looks like. Which themes are you excited about for 2021, 2022 industries or areas of opportunity that you believe have been accelerated and are really ripe for business building?
I mean, I started out talking about corporate law and talking about sort of my journey from moving from that to doing venture building. And I think what I said was that I felt stifled. And I believe that many people are stifled in the workplace. But I also believe that many people are stifled, or at least not set up to really achieve their full potential through our education system. And I've long been sort of passionate and interested in what does the future of education look like. And I think that the impact of Corona and what we're seeing today in terms of, for want of a better expression, taking education online has, of course, like in many other sectors, accelerated the path of development of the future of education. And I think that's super exciting just for me because it goes back to what I would say is, you know, my sort of personal mission, which is about unstifling people and supporting and empowering people to fulfill their potential. So from a very sort of fundamental personal standpoint, I'm super excited about what that looks like and what can be built over the next few years, because the opportunity is now more so than it's ever been. So that's something that I'm super excited to see. How we might play a role in that as Rainmaking, I don't yet know, and we shall see how that plays out. I guess the other one for me personally is, having started out as a lawyer, then I do think there's a massive opportunity to create the future of the future law firm. And so that's something that's also super interesting for me.
So Sam, thank you so much for sharing your story. It's really also inspiring to hear how you follow your passion, got unstuck, and now are empowering others to do the same and excel in their lives. Really beautiful message. And thanks again.
Thank you. Lovely to speak to you. Thanks very much for hosting me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Lost in Transformation with our host Sebastian from Ming Labs. If you enjoy our podcast, please subscribe to our channel and leave us a review on iTunes. Join us next time for another episode of our podcast.